Welcome to the Original Jurisdiction Podcast. I'm your host, David Latt, author of a Substack newsletter about law and the legal profession, also named Original Jurisdiction, which you can read and subscribe to at davidlatt.substack.com. You're listening to the 40th episode of this podcast, recorded on Tuesday, February 27th. Thanks to this podcast's sponsor, NextFirm. NextFirm helps big law attorneys become founding partners. To learn more about how NextFirm can help you launch your firm, call 212-292-1000 or email careerdevelopment@nextfirm.com. Want to know who the guest will be for the next Original Jurisdiction podcast? Follow NextFirm on LinkedIn for a preview. Speaking of big law attorneys turned founding partners, my latest guest is the founding partner of not one but two boutiques. He is also, like a number of my guests, an old friend. David Ellsberg is a founding partner of Ellsberg, Baker & Maruri, which launched just last month. It refers to itself as a trial firm because, in Ellsberg's words, its partners are veteran trial lawyers, not just litigators, but lawyers who know their way around a courtroom. Before launching Ellsberg, Baker & Maruri, David was a founding partner of Selendy Gay Ellsberg, today one of the nation's leading litigation boutiques. Prior to Selendy Gay Ellsberg, David was a partner for more than a decade at Quinn Emanuel. And before Quinn, he was an associate at Wachtell Lipton, which is where we met more than 20 years ago. David was always one of my favorite people to work with at Wachtell, and over the years, I've followed his career with interest and admiration. Today, he's recognized as one of the nation's top commercial litigators by Chambers, Law 360, Law Dragon, and Benchmark Litigation, among other authorities. But he's not just a great litigator. He's also a founding partner twice over, and he has some excellent insights into how to structure and run a law firm. I've been meaning to have him on the podcast for a while, and when I saw the big news about the launch of Ellsberg, Baker & Maruri, I thought, now's my chance. Without further ado, here's my conversation with David Ellsberg. David, thank you so much for joining me.
Happy to be here.
So let's start at the beginning. Tell us about your childhood, your upbringing. Where did you grow up?
So I grew up in Queens and then Long Island. And my mother, she was a public school teacher, but she stopped teaching before she had children. My father, he was a teacher, then an assistant principal, and then he led a union that represented public school principals and assistant principals. So grew up, had a great childhood, was very happy. And that's the basic idea.
Did his union work give you any exposure to law and legal topics?
No, that didn't give me any exposure to law and legal topics, but my parents were just sort of very engaged with public events and they would talk about it a lot. And pretty much what we did at our dinner table was argue. It was just, I mean, really, I think every single night, I don't know that I can remember a time that we had dinner where we weren't all arguing about something and it was kind of chaotic, people talking over each other. And that's the closest that I came to being exposed to at least being a litigator.
That sounds like great training for being a litigator. My husband Zach's family is exactly like that too. Did you have any lawyers elsewhere in your family, even if not your parents?
No.
So what drew you into law?
It was really that I liked arguing. And I then had a teacher called Mr. Breedus. He was a history teacher in high school. The way that he taught the class is he would ask someone their view on something that we had read about, and then he would say, who disagrees? And then call on that. So it was really sort of debating the whole time. I loved that class. And he said to me at one point, have you thought about this? You seem to like doing this. There's a job that could be good for you. So it was the combination of really liking the arguing. And look, I was a Jewish kid with Jewish parents. So, you know, heard about wouldn't be terrible if you were a doctor or a lawyer. So
exactly.
It may have sort of seeped in that way also.
Where did you go to high school, by the way?
It was Lawrence High School.
And what topic did he teach? Was this history, social studies?
Yes, it was history, which then became my major in college, I think largely because I loved that class.
And then you went straight through to Harvard Law School, right? And I'm guessing you enjoyed law school then, given what you've already told me about what you enjoy.
Yeah, I loved it. I really loved law school. Yeah.
And then you clerked for Judge Kearse on the Second Circuit. What was that experience like?
It was amazing. She was and is a towering intellect. Her writing was superb, very trenchant, concise. and her thinking process. I just learned a tremendous amount about thinking and writing. It really made a big difference. I still will think sometimes, how would Judge Kearse think about this, and at least aspire to try to emulate that?
It's interesting. A friend of mine who clerked on the Second Circuit said his boss, his judge, said that Judge Kearse is the smartest member of that court. You don't need to agree or disagree with that, but that's just one anonymous person's opinion. But she's also a renowned bridge player. Do you play bridge?
Yes. No, I don't play bridge, but I marveled at that because somehow she was a champion bridge player, I think a nationally ranked bridge player. And I was always thinking, how do you pull off being a Second Circuit judge and maintain some sort of ranking as a bridge player? I mean, this is the person who had a tremendous capacity to do lots of things that involved a lot of brain power.
Speaking of a tremendous capacity to do a lot of brain work, you then went to Wachtell Lipton, which is actually where we met years ago.
Yes.
Yes. And I have to tell you, I always really admired you because in such a demanding environment, you just seem to have a lot of stamina. And honestly, when I think of the qualities that are required to have a long career in private practice, sure, being smart helps and being charming for rainmaking purposes helps. But sometimes I think it's just a stamina game.
I think that's part of it for sure, is stamina, especially as a trial lawyer. As you know, the hours can be very long and you can need to go without sleep sometimes. I think the stamina is very, very closely linked to whether or not you love the job. Because if you're loving it, if you really are passionate about it, if you get jazzed when you're getting close to trial, it's a labor of love and you're not thinking, oh my God, I just want to get out of here and go to sleep. So for me, I think that is the driver.
I think that's such a great point because I remember when I was at Wachtell and we'd go to the attorney dining room and people would be talking about their work. I enjoyed the work and I really even more appreciated the opportunity to work with people like you. But they would talk about the cases in such a way where I kind of thought, I kind of like this and find this interesting and the pay is nice and all, but I don't know that I have that same passion that the folks, well, you and others did.
Well, you did a really good job of faking it. I never would have known.
Well, there were a couple of times when a certain partner we both worked for would get us a little beaten down, but we survived. And then tell me about your career after Wachtell.
So my career after Wachtell really started at a trial that you and I worked on. So you may remember IBP versus Tyson.
Yes, that was a great matter.
It was a great matter. And that happened when I was a few years into Wachtell. And I loved it. I just loved everything about that experience, even though, as you'll remember, I wasn't doing any stand-up work. It was behind the scenes. But I loved it, going to court. And it was also these masterful lawyers. Bernie Nussbaum was on it. I remember Mark Walensky was on it. There were others who were just dynamite lawyers. And the high point of my young career was in the middle of that trial, I was sent to do a deposition of a witness who was supposed to be a minor witness. And I asked the question, what did your lawyer say to you? And the witness answered and said something that was somehow damaging to their case. And then Bernie Nussbaum played a couple of clips of the deposition at the trial. It was probably, 15 seconds for each clip. But to me, I was just over the moon. And so I was bit by the trial bug. And I then decided, okay, this is what I want to do. And just like any relatively big law firm, I looked ahead and realized it could take a really long time before I'm really doing a significant amount at trial. That's what I want to do. And so I did something pretty much everyone I knew called me crazy. I left Wachtell to go to a law firm that most people had never heard of. It was a 10-person firm. They were known for doing lots of arbitrations and lots of trials. I just loved it there because I was getting to do what I wanted to do. And I was then in back-to-back arbitrations against Quinn Emanuel. And at the time, Quinn Emanuel had maybe, I'm guessing, but maybe 35, 40 lawyers in the New York office. This was before there were any offices overseas. And they then asked if I wanted to join. And I jumped at the chance because they were a trial law firm and they were really doing trials on a bigger scale. So I was there for about, I think, 12 years or so. Loved it there. They're just such incredibly talented lawyers there. And the day I left, I loved it there. I loved the people there, but it was the opportunity to build something. And that is when I was one of the co-founders of Selendy Gay, which became Selendy Gay Ellsberg. And I was there until very recently when my now colleagues and I started Ellsberg, Baker, and Marori.
What led you to go from Quinn Emanuel, which is a great firm? And as you mentioned, you were still loving it there. You hadn't soured on the place or on trial work. What led you to join the founding partners, Faith and Philippe, at Selendy Gay Ellsberg?
I had done a lot in my career at that point. In terms of what a litigator does, the whole spectrum of things, I had not ever built a law firm from the bottom up. And that idea just seemed like a thrilling idea and something that could be extremely satisfying. And it was also something that, in a good way, was a stretch. You don't learn in law school, at least I didn't, anything about how to build a business, how to build a law firm. You learn how to do the lawyering. And it was an opportunity to be a participant in architecting what would the place look like? What would the values be? And that was a very, very compelling opportunity.
And when did you assume the role of managing partner there?
Right out of the gate. So the first 4 years.
So you went over there already understanding that you would be involved in this managerial role?
Yes, I did.
And was that an attraction? Because a lot of times people who love trial work, as you do, kind of think the managing is sort of something you do because it's expected of you if you are a high-ranking person at the firm, or it's a form of service to the firm. But you were drawn to that, even if it would take you out of the courtroom?
So I was, and there were a couple of reasons. So to the point that you were just making, the design was it would not be as time-consuming as being a managing partner is at other firms. So the goal was to have a very strong professional staff, so a very strong COO, a very strong CFO, so that it would not be dominating. So it was meant to take up much less time, and it did, and that was good. But a lot of it I did not like. It's not my first love, and there was a good amount of stuff I didn't like. So for example, when HR issues would arise, I never liked being involved in that. Nobody's happy when an HR issue arises. I didn't find it interesting. It was just something that had to be done. There were some other parts of it that were interesting and satisfying. So there are some types of decisions about how certain things that were important to me and that I found interesting, that was very satisfying. And also, I didn't realize it at the time, but being in that position really sets you up for if you ever wanted to start a firm, because you're deeply involved in the decisions that are being made as the firm is just launching.
Yeah, and I want to get to that in just a second, because that's one of the reasons I wanted to have you on to talk about the launch of your new firm. But before we leave the courtroom part of it, can you talk about maybe a case or two from your time as a litigator and trial lawyer of which you're most proud, or that is particularly memorable or interesting?
So the ones that I am most proud of are the ones where anybody looking at it would say, you should lose this case. The odds are against you. And then if you win, then you really feel like, okay, I really contributed and added value and sort of puzzled through how do you get this over the goal line. And there have been a couple that are like that. I'm actually not going to name them now because it would be saying we should have lost the case. But there was an arbitration that I did where the contract was awful. just absolutely awful for our client. But what had happened to our client was and looked very unfair. And so we went in, and you know, in arbitration, they don't have to be as strict about following the law. And they were convinced that this is the wrong outcome. We need to do something to help the client. And we got a very good ruling on that one. There is another one that I did where the adversary brought a claim where if they won, it would have shut down our client's business completely. And they also were seeking hundreds of millions of dollars. So it really would have been lethal. And we defeated the claims. The judge held that the company can continue with its business model. And that felt really good because the stakes were just so high. And there have been a couple of others like that where they're true bet the company cases. And so coming out of those and you've saved the client, that's a tremendous feeling.
Yeah, it's interesting. Sometimes people say, what is meant by bet the company litigation? And that's a great example. Or even IBP v. Tyson, that was a multi-billion dollar case. And I think a lot of people gave Wachtell long odds on that one because it wasn't really common back then to order a specific performance. I think it's become more common since then. So I totally understand what you're saying about feeling you contributed value, because if you are probably, I'm not really a poker player, but it's probably like that. Like if you're dealt a great hand, you don't need to do anything. You just play your hand. But if you can actually add value, I think that really can make a difference.
Yes, for sure. And it also requires a tolerance for calculated risks. You can't be the type of lawyer who only wants to take on cases that look like they're winners from the outset. You have to be willing to understand, look, part of my job as a trial lawyer is I'm going to lose sometimes, but I'm going to take difficult cases because there is a real path to winning, even if the odds at the start are against us.
How many times, though, do you have to tell a client, basically, your case is a dog? Like, you got to settle this. There's really nothing that can be done. How often do you have to do that? And is that hard?
The way that I will describe it to a client is typically along the lines of saying, I'll tell you what I think the likelihood is of winning, or what the likelihood is of winning on this claim, that claim, the other claim. And there are lots of situations where I'll say to the client, your odds of winning this are 20%. The odds of winning this one, 35%, 40%, whatever it is. But then the conversation leads to, what is that 20% worth? What is it worth to you? And one thing that it can translate into is, pick your number. If it's a $1 billion case, 20% of 1 billion, that's a lot. And the other side, they'll be sophisticated and they'll realize they have a 20% chance of winning. And so there's a lot of value there. Do you know what I mean? You don't have to have something that if it goes all the way, it's necessarily going to be a winner. And then there are times where the client does not want to settle. What they're looking for is something else. They want their day in court, or it's reputational. So there are a lot of times where there are reasons that a client will say, I understand this is less than 50%, but I want to pursue this case. And in my view, if it's an argument that has merit, you're not pushing the envelope, it's just not one that is at the beginning likely to win. As long as the client goes in eyes wide open, knowing what the odds are, or at least best prediction of what the odds are, that I think is a case that is worth doing. You're not there only to make sure that you win for a client. You're there to achieve whatever their goals are.
So turning now to the launch of Ellsberg, Baker & Marrury, what led you to decide to leave Schlumberger Ellsberg, where things were going great from what I understand? The firm has grown rapidly. It seems to be winning lots of major cases. So again, it seems kind of like your situation at Quinn Emanuel. Everything was kind of chugging along very nicely. So what led you to go out on your own?
Same type of thing. It was not trying to get away from something as much as it was going to something that was very compelling to me. So Rollo Baker and Silpa Marrury, they are just tremendous lawyers who I worked with when I was at Quinn Emanuel. For years, we worked together very closely in lots of cases. We did lots of trials together. And when I was one of the people founding Selendy Galesburg, it just was, for a variety of reasons, not a moment when Silpa and Rallo and also Jared Ruocco, who also was at Quinn when I was there, he was a tremendous lawyer. It was not a moment where it was going to be feasible for them to be part of it. Now, the stars sort of aligned where they were in a position to do it. It was an opportunity to sort of be with those people who I thought were fantastic. And we all share sort of philosophy or approach to litigation. And I really love that. So I couldn't pass that up. And when my partners, Mike Duke and Vivek Tata, said that they would join, I couldn't have been happier, because it's just a group of people. And we just have fun together. We like each other. We joke around with each other. And our work styles are really mesh.
I've been struck by that, interviewing a number of founders of boutiques, that a lot of times it was just the opportunity to practice with people that you really enjoy spending time with and you really admire as lawyers. So I've noticed that there has been this trend of a lot of great lawyers, especially litigators, leaving large firms to start boutiques. I know you left Big Law a while ago when you left Quinn Emanuel, but do you have any thoughts on why that is?
I think that there are a couple of reasons. I think one is that clients have, across the board, not just for litigation, they've started hiring lawyers more than law firms. Another is, when it comes to litigation, I think at the big full service firms, what often happens is the litigators will be fed cases from the transactional lawyers. So the transactional lawyers will do a deal, then something happens. A contract is breached, there's some dispute. And I think the clients have realized that that does not always mean that they're getting the best litigator, the right litigator for that job. And also, there are things that can be awkward about having a litigator that's chosen in that way, because their colleagues were involved in the events that are the underlying dispute. And the firm is going to have natural incentives to deal with it in a way that is not going to end up making their colleagues vulnerable in any respect. So I think that's another reason. And I also think that for litigators, if you're in a firm that's a full service firm, it's not always this way, but it can be that the firm is designed, and this is everything from technology through the way decisions are made about every aspect of the firm, that the firm can be designed for practices different than litigation. And if it's a litigation-only firm, every single thing about the place is designed to optimize the service that you can give to clients as a litigator.
And I think that's a great point, and I can think of two areas, billing and conflicts, where the policy that is crafted to govern the entire firm may work better for practices other than litigation.
Yeah.
So let me ask you this then, as I've certainly discovered interviewing lots of boutique founders, there are a lot of really amazing litigation boutiques in New York and beyond New York. What do you think will make the firm stand out in a town with a lot of great, small, nimble litigation shops?
Yeah. So there are a couple of things that we're doing that go strongly against trends that have become very prevalent. So one thing that we're doing is we're not going to have any non-equity partners, and it's going to be a 7-year track, and then you're up for equity partner. That's the exact opposite of what has been happening generally, where more and more non-equity partners are being made, and the length of the non-equity track has gotten longer, meaning it takes a lot longer to get to equity partner. Another, which goes in the opposite direction of the prevailing practice, is we are going to have a modified lockstep compensation system for the partners with a pretty compressed band, meaning the difference between what a first-year partner makes and the most senior will by design be more compressed than most places, with the idea that if you want to get star associates and you want to get and keep star young lawyers, and you want to give them, the young associates, a lot of experience, I don't think you're going to keep people who are fantastic unless they really feel that they are literally, they own the place. They literally have ownership. And so it's also designed to set the incentives right. So you put whoever is the right person on a team. Another thing that we're doing is we've designed it so that it'll have more diffusion of decision-making power than a lot of firms. So we're trying to avoid a situation where you have a couple of people, say a managing partner, a co-managing partner, or a name partner that is the one that is making most of the important decisions. We're going to divide decision-making up with the idea that, number one, a firm should reflect the views and the will of the partnership broadly. And number two, the better decisions are made when you have diversity of people who are making the decisions. Another thing that we've started doing, and I think will be a differentiator, is the experience that we are giving to our youngest lawyers. So for a long time, I've believed, and the people that are starting this have believed, that a key part of a really strong, successful firm is you start with first years, giving them stand-up experience. So by the time they're up at their seventh year, they really, really know what they're doing. And there are ways to do that. There are ways to make sure that even the youngest lawyers are able to do that right out of the gate.
Have you ever wondered what your career could be if you founded a boutique firm designed exclusively for your practice? Rafael Janov, a class action and mass arbitration lawyer representing consumers, workers, and small businesses, recently formed Janov PLLC with NextFirm's help. Better compensation, cost structures, and enhanced operational capabilities allow him to pursue more rewarding representations and bring more favorable outcomes to his clients. Call NextFirm to learn about how you, too, might take your career to the next level. So I have to say, your firm in many ways sounds kind of like a nirvana for smart, ambitious young lawyers who really want to get on their feet and have a stake in the place they're working in. But let me offer a couple of points of possible pushback, because the trends you identify, they're happening for a reason. So first of all, on the issue of compensation, are you not worried that you might lose your top rainmakers, yourself included? Maybe you won't quit, but you know your partners, aren't you worried about losing top rainmakers if you don't have that yawning Kirkland-esque dozens to one, they call it the spread from the compensation of the lowest partner to the highest paid partner? Like, if you don't have a giant spread, how are you going to keep your rainmakers? Because at the bottom or the origin of every big law firm dissolution is a key group of rainmakers heading for the door.
Yeah, so that's where the modification comes in. So you have the lockstep band, and then there is going to be a percentage that a partner will get of cases that the partner brings in. So it can then grow above the 5-to-1, but everybody at all the partners, the whole firm, shares in the bulk of what each partner brings in. And then we're also going to have a cap so that if someone is bringing in an enormous amount of business, there will be an upper cap that a partner can get to. Again, on the theory that whenever you're working on cases, big cases, successful cases, it's not one person that's doing it. It's a team of people that are doing it. And look, also, I think there'll be self-selection in it. And I think if you have somebody who does not want to be part of that system, then it might be a good thing if they say, you know what, I'm going to go elsewhere. I don't like the way this is working, because we do think that the incentives will be set in a way that will keep teamwork and collegiality. So that is what we're looking at. And again, I think the modified part of the lockstep will help avoid that concern where a big rainmaker thinks, wait a second, this is making no difference in my comp.
Sure. And, you know, of course, the devil's in the details. Paul Weiss has a modified lockstep. It's interesting that you talk about a cap, though, because you could imagine the quote unquote modification getting so large that it kind of is not that different from a Kirkland-esque system. But I also see your point, though, about people knowing in advance what your system is. I am guessing then that you might have to do a lot of organic growth, because a lot of times, as I know from my little detour into recruiting, partners move opportunistically for economic reasons. And if given a modified lockstep system, as opposed to a system that is heavily incentivized towards rainmaking and origination, you may have a hard time getting lateral partners and you may grow more organically.
Yeah. So first, we like the idea of growing organically, because one thing is, if we're going to have a 7-year track, we're going to have people coming up for equity partner. And it's nice to be able to have real partnership opportunities, or we may bring in laterals. But you're right, it probably is not going to be lots of laterals, but we want the young lawyers to get training and then have a real shot at partner. And the second thing is, there are models of success in that way. One is, at least my understanding, I think it's still true, but the firm where we both got our start, Wachtell Lipton, is an example of a firm that grows organically, not 100%, but largely. And I believe that they have some kind of a general lockstep system with some modifications. And that certainly, it's an understatement to say it's been a success.
Yes, no, absolutely. And I think I actually thought about our old firm when I was thinking about your model, because it has a relatively short partnership track. It has no non-equity partners. It doesn't have many laterals, and it's phenomenally successful. But part of that has to do with the fact that they have profitability that is very high. And so even a partner on their lockstep can do better than a lot of partners under an eat what you kill system. Let me ask you this. What types of, and you can be pretty general, what types of fee arrangements are you planning to have? I know Quinn Emanuel, for example, has encountered success over the years doing contingency fee arrangements. Are you open to alternative fees, or do you think you'll be mainly focused on the hourly billing?
We'll be open to alternative fees. Most of what we do will be hourly. And I include in that arrangements where there is some kind of a success fee. So for example, you might give a discount, make up a number, a 15% discount or 20% discount, whatever it is. And that's tied to a success fee that's a multiple of the amount of deferred fees. So if at the end of a case, if it was a 15% discount, if the amount that that 15% would have equated to is $10, then you get $30 if it's a 3x success fee. I don't think that we're going to be doing a lot of contingency cases, at least in the early years, where it's a true contingency case.
Yeah, and those can be risky. What I like about the approach of a discount with a essentially kind of kicker for success is it allows you to sort of keep your lights on, because you're still getting something to cover your overhead. But it also means that if the client gets a great result, you share in that success. Because when I talk to in-house lawyers, they'll complain about $2,500 an hour or what have you. But what they really hate is paying a lot of money for a terrible result. If they get a fantastic result that saves their company, they're not going to complain. They don't complain much about that. But when they pay through the nose for a terrible outcome, they really don't like that. So I see your point on that. And then my last sort of point of pushback, I guess, if you will, is I think it's great that you're going to give young lawyers real responsibility, but aren't a lot of your clients coming because they're going to be getting one of the three of you? How are you going to get clients to become comfortable with handing these major matters over to these youngins?
Yeah, actually, there's a way to do it that has been very successful. I started doing this a long time ago. Clients generally do not come in thinking, I want a first year doing this deposition or this witness at trial. The way that it ends up working really successfully is by saying to the client, I have this deposition. I'd like to let this first year do just one topic, or how about half an hour? Then the associate performs really well. And then the next one, half a deposition, and so on. And then the client sees this lawyer is junior, but this lawyer really knows what they're doing. And then by the time you get to the trial or you get to the arbitration, you can do the same thing. And judges and arbitrators, every time that I've done this, they've been very enthusiastic and supportive. When you say, Your Honor, would it be okay? I'd like to split this examination with one of my younger colleagues. And that's a way that they get up on their feet and the client feels this is safe. You know, I already know this person can do it. The gray beard is going to be right there. So there is a way to do it. And it works out so well for everyone when that happens. And there's a recent example where we had a fourth year associate who now has Joy and Ellsberg, Baker and Marori. He's just a star. And he had never done a witness before. He had come from a big firm. And he ended up doing a major cross-examination in an arbitration, very high stakes, and he killed it. And again, it's great for everyone. He now has the experience. The client got a great cross-examination. And it was because he built trust over the whole process up until the arbitration hearing.
That's a great way to do it. And I'm really impressed. I'm struck by how much you've thought through these issues just in terms of institutional design. I think a lot of firms grow organically, but that extends not just to the talent, but also to policies and procedures and structure. And sometimes it can kind of be good if you've taken a step back at the outset to kind of think, what's the best way to structure something rather than what's the convenient way at the outset to do it? Because there's a kind of inertia or a kind of path dependency if you start your firm doing something a certain way. So I'm really impressed by just the thought you've put into these questions of firm design, if you will.
Well, that's the upside of having really smart and thoughtful partners.
So let's now turn to my little speed round. These are four questions that I ask of all my guests. My first question is, what do you like the least about the law? And this can either be the practice of law or law as a more abstract system of governance.
Two things. One is having to record time, you know, having to write down time. I don't know anyone who likes it. Reviewing invoices, nobody has fun doing that. You have to do it and you have to do it right. But if somehow I could snap my fingers and nobody had to do that, that's what I would do. The other one, and this is a more serious issue, is in the United States, at least with the American rule, there are cases where something wrong really did happen to somebody and they should be able to make it right by going to court. But the cost of litigation is, especially for individuals, absolutely prohibitive, especially when it's an individual up against an entity that has all the resources in the world to fight it. And there's a category of cases that fall in between what typically a firm would want to do as a pro bono case and the big cases that you do for entities where you just have people who, yeah, they have good jobs and they're very nice lifestyle, middle class. If there's some case against an entity, it could be almost impossible for someone to afford justice, essentially.
Mm-hmm. That's so, so true. And it's part of this larger access to justice crisis that we face in the country. My second question, and I'll be interested to hear your answer to this because you did go straight from college to law school. What would you be if you were not a lawyer?
I've thought that I could love a job outside. And I've thought about what would it be like to build houses? There's a friend of mine who does that. He seems to love it. But I would also, I think, in reality, be absolutely awful at it. Whenever I try any, you know, fix something up in my home, it becomes a disaster. And then it becomes a source of my family making fun of me forever about this ridiculous thing that I tried to do and screwed it up.
We don't even try that in our household. We stay in our lane and we have a great handyman, fortunately. My third question is, how much sleep do you get each night?
I don't get a lot of sleep. I've always had trouble sleeping. This is forever since I was a kid. So I would say on average, maybe 5 hours or so a night. And that's not because I want to. It's I try to fall asleep. I have trouble. And people who work with me know it's not unusual at all that I'll be sending emails, not expecting anyone to respond. But, you know, if I'm sending an email at 2 a.m, 3 a.m, it's not unusual.
Again, I remember a certain partner we used to work with who would send emails in the middle of the night, but it doesn't make you feel tired or run down? Or do you feel tired and run down, but you just kind of roll through it?
It's a mix. You know, sometimes if I've really had trouble sleeping, that's going to make me feel a little bit run down. And then most days, no, it's just sort of that's how it's been my whole life. You know what I mean?
Yep.
It's normal to me to not be able to go to sleep and get 8 hours of sleep.
And they have done studies showing that there's a small percentage of people who just don't need as much sleep as other people. So great if you're one of them. My last question is, any final words of wisdom, such as career advice or life advice for my listeners?
The career advice is for young lawyers is do everything you can right out of the gate to try to get the types of experience that you're looking for. And what that means is just asking a lot over and over again, because one of the times you ask, someone is going to say, yes, you can do this. And once you have the experience, there's this virtuous upward cycle. You have experience, it's easier to get experience. So I always say, ask, just ask, and people know you want to do it. And another thing, this is really for young lawyers that are litigators, is look for TROs, especially TROs that are happening on a Friday, because mostly people don't want to raise their hands for that. They run from it. But it's a really good way for young lawyers to get quick trial experience. And because of the very compressed time frame, it often means you need a number of lawyers doing lots of things quickly, double tracking, triple tracking depositions, for example. So it's a really good way to get experience, real experience, earlier than you might otherwise get it.
I love that. I love those two really practical pieces of advice. Thank you so much for joining me, David, and best of luck to you and your colleagues as you build your new firm.
Thank you, David. Appreciate that you spoke with me.
Thanks so much to David for joining me. It's always great to see old friends thriving. And on that note, my next guest is another former colleague who has been up to exciting things. Thanks to NextFirm for sponsoring the Original Jurisdiction podcast. NextFirm has helped many attorneys to leave big law and launch firms of their own. To explore this opportunity, please contact NextFirm at 212-292-1000 or email careerdevelopment@nextfirm.com to learn more. Thanks to Tommy Herron, my sound engineer here at Original Jurisdiction, and thanks to you, my listeners and readers. To connect with me, please email me at davidlatt@substack.com or find me on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn at David Latt, and on Instagram at David Benjamin Latt. If you enjoyed today's episode, please rate, review, and subscribe. Please subscribe to the Original Jurisdiction newsletter if you don't already, over at davidlatt.substack.com. This podcast is free, but it's made possible by paid subscriptions to the newsletter. The next episode should appear 2 weeks from now, on or about Wednesday, March 20. Until then, may your thinking be original and your jurisdiction free of defects.